From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air Weekend. Today, comic and actor Wanda Sykes.
If you voted for Trump, and you came to see me?
That's how Sykes opens her Netflix comedy special called Not Normal, which is nominated for 2 Emmys. Her comedy draws on being African-American and a lesbian married to a white woman. They have 2 white children. Sykes jokes that when white family or friends visit, she feels like a minority in her own home.
And sometimes I'll call a friend like, hey, man, what you doing? You want to come over? And he goes, what, you got too many white people in your house? I'm like, yeah.
Also, we hear from Laura Lippman, author of the Tess Monaghan Detective Series. She has a new standalone mystery novel called Lady in the Lake. Stephen King described it as extraordinary in his New York Times book review.
Support for this NPR podcast and the following message come from Curio Collection by Hilton, inviting you to choose from a fascinating list of independent hotels around the world, each with its own story to tell. The Candler Hotel in Atlanta and the C. Baldwin in Houston are 2 of the collection's finest examples of repurposing history to create distinct experiences for their guests. Named after local legends, soda magnate Asa Griggs Candler and the mother of Houston, Charlotte Baldwin. Are you curious? Visit Hilton.com/NPR.
My guest is comic, actor, and writer Wanda Sykes. Her Netflix comedy special, Not Normal, is nominated for 2 Emmys. Not Normal is the expression she uses to describe the Trump presidency, which she devotes a lot of time to in the special. During the Obama presidency, Sykes became the first African-American woman to perform at the White House Correspondents' Dinner. She came out right after Obama was elected, which was the same time Proposition 8 made gay marriage illegal in California. She's now married. She talks about race and her family in the special.
Race means a lot. It does. I think about it a lot. Just because of the makeup of my family. Look, I'm married to a white French woman, and we have 2 white kids. Yeah. And now white supremacy is on the rise. And I'm living with a house full of white people.
In her special, Sykes also talks about being diagnosed with breast cancer and having a double mastectomy. And now she's going through menopause, dealing with hot flashes, belly fat, and she's afraid she's starting to grow a beard.
But, you know, there's help, you know. There's a solution. Like, a lot of women, they just take the estrogen. Just take the hormone. But see, I can't take the estrogen. I can't take the hormone because of the type of breast cancer I had. Yeah. But the irony of it all is like when, you know, because I curse and stuff, and when people say to me, hey, Wanda, you know, really, would it kill you to be a little more ladylike? I go, yes. It would.
We'll hear more of Wanda Sykes' comedy later. Sykes has a recurring role on Black-ish, does a lot of voice work for animated films, and has her own production company. Wanda Sykes, welcome to Fresh Air, and congratulations on your Emmy nominations.
Thank you.
You've been a comic during the Clinton administration and his impeachment. You were a comic during 2 terms of America's first African-American president. And now you're a comic during the presidency of Donald Trump, who some people describe as racially divisive and others describe as just plain racist. Is being a comic now different than being a comic during the Clinton years or the Obama years?
Oh, it's totally different. It's much harder, actually. And you would think, oh, boy, there's so much to make fun of. But really, I can't write anything funnier or more ridiculous than what Trump actually says. What he says, it sounds like a joke. So it's basically, you're just repeating what he says. It's like doing a parody of a parody.
You were booed by an audience in Boston telling jokes.
Oh, thanks, Terry. Yeah, thanks. Jesus.
Telling jokes about Trump.
Oh, congratulations on your Emmys. Oh, hey, remember when you were booed, Wanda?
And you had called him racist, sexist, and homophobic. Were you surprised to get booed? I mean, these are people who are paying money to come hear you. I would imagine most people who come hear you aren't surprised to hear what you think of President Trump.
Well, you know what? That was my fault. That was my fault because it wasn't my show, you know? And when I say fault, I don't mean that, you know, that I take responsibility for being booed. I take responsibility as being a comic and not reading the room. You know, it's like I'm in Boston and it was a benefit for the Cam Neely Foundation. And, you know, my friend Dennis Leary asked me to do it. And I've performed there before, and it's a great charity, and it's usually a fun night at the Garden. But this was right after the election. So Dennis goes up, and he does some Trump jokes, and people are laughing. And then another comic goes up, and he does a couple jokes, whatever, you know, some Trump stuff, and people are laughing, another white guy. And so then I go up, and I do it, you know, the first joke is, you know, I get some laughs. It was a Trump joke. And then the second joke was the, hey, you know, this isn't the first time we've had a president who's, you know, racist, homophobic, sexist, but this is just the first one that we can confirm. And the crowd just turned then. And it was like, oh, and then I got it. I was like, oh, shoot, that's right. I forgot. I'm a black lesbian female, and they aren't ready for this yet. You know, it's like white guys, sure, go ahead, come on out. You can make fun of it because we see it every night on late night TV. White guys making fun of the president. Okay, yeah, and especially this president, fine. But they weren't ready to see a black woman who's happened to be a lesbian also making fun of the president. And the room, it was 50-50. I mean, like fist fights broke out in the audience.
Are you serious?
I'm serious. It's Boston. Come on. I mean, really, it was nuts. It was nuts. People were doing the Heil Hitler move. I heard N-words. I heard, you know, then you hear other people, you know, telling them to you know, shut up and all that. It was crazy.
So what did you do on stage?
I said I have to try to somehow diffuse this, so I pulled out my cancer card. You know, I was like, hey, we're here for the Cam Neely Foundation.
Is that a cancer foundation? And,
so it's a form of cancer. Yeah, uh-huh. Yeah. And I was like, okay, hey, guess what? We're here for a good cause. You know, I had cancer, and then people kind of like settled down, and then I got them back. I did. I got them back, and you know, and there was still some rumblings going on in the audience. But I wrapped up my set, and you know, and then as I said thank you and bye, and as I was walking off the stage, my wife was there, and she runs out on the stage and grabs me, and you know, just gives me a big kiss. And so, again, half the audience is going nuts, you know, like applauding. And the other half is like, wait a minute, what's going on? What's happening? Why is this white woman kissing her now? What is going on? And my wife, she's, you know, smarter than I am. So as we're leaving, she throws up the peace sign. And me, still bitter, I gave him the finger. And I believe that was on the front page of the Boston, on the Globe or something the next morning. It was pretty funny.
Very much
one
a mixed message.
Moments.
The moral of the story.
And then my wife and I had to talk about it. I was like, wait a minute. I thought we were both doing the finger. She's like, no, baby, I was doing the peace sign. Love, peace. I was like, oh. I was like, no, nah, I was feeling the finger. I couldn't get that index up one. Couldn't get that index finger up. Mm-mm.
Oh, that's really funny. Is life for you personally different under President Trump than it was under President Obama?
Yes, absolutely. I have to. You have to think about things now. You know, when you even like something simple as going into a restaurant. You know, you go in and you see it's kind of crowded. And you try to get. You say, okay, you want a table. I have to read the host. I have to read the hostess to see how this is going to go down. Like, oh boy, if this person is, you know, a Trump person, we might as well just go to another restaurant.
Are you concerned because you're black, because you're a lesbian, because you're a famous comic? Like
you can check all those boxes.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
So on the scale of annoyed to afraid, where are you now?
Wow. Okay. I'm more on the end of annoyed because I don't live in fear. It's just like you said. It's just another annoyance. It's just, you know, something that you just got to deal with. Like, oh God, really this again? So I'm like 10 on the, you know, annoyance level.
And annoyance in part because you feel like you have to read people more carefully than you did before because it's such a divisive time.
Right. And what's so funny, people who are not Trump supporters, especially white people, I can feel like they want you to know that where they stand, which is hilarious because it's like they're being racially profiled now, you know. So I know like white people are quick to tell me, oh, that Trump, huh? Oh God, what a piece of work. And I'm like, we weren't even talking about politics. I just met you, you know. It's just so funny where they just feel like, okay, let me just get this out right away.
So I want to play something from an earlier special. This is from a 2009 comedy special on HBO that was called I'ma Be Me. And this is something you recorded about how you felt after Obama was elected.
First black president. I'm so happy because now I can relax a little bit. You know, I can loosen up. Don't have to be so black all the time. Don't have to be so dignified. You know, because we did it. Black folks, we always got to be dignified. Yeah, because we know if we just set everybody else back a couple of years, right? Well, we should have killed Flavor Flav like 10 years ago. He has been holding us back. But we did it. Now I can relax a little bit. I can dance on camera. I couldn't dance on camera before. When I was growing up, my mother, she wouldn't even let us dance in the car. You know, we sitting in the car, good song come on the radio, my mother's like, she would stop the car. Do you want to dance or do you want to ride? Because you ain't dancing in my car. White people are looking at you. Like, huh? White people are looking at you. I'm like, oh, damn. She was right.
That's Wanda Sykes from her 2009 special. Did your mother tell you that white people are looking at you, so you got to be dignified?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, my parents. I don't know, you know, another black person my age who didn't hear that. Yeah.
My guest is comic, actor, and writer Wanda Sykes. Her Netflix comedy special, Not Normal, is nominated for 2 Emmys, Outstanding Variety Special and Outstanding Writing for a Variety Special. We'll talk more after a break. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air Weekend.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Neon, presenting Loose, a psychological thriller hailed by First Showing as the most provocative film of the 2019 Sundance Film Festival, and which the film stage calls a major work of contemporary cinema. Featuring acclaimed performances from Oscar winner Octavia Spencer, Naomi Watts, Tim Roth, and Kelvin Harrison Jr., Loose is now playing in select cities, additional markets throughout August.
Let's get back to my interview with comic, actor, and writer Wanda Sykes. Her Netflix comedy special, Not Normal, is nominated for 2 Emmys. She's been doing comedy about President Trump and about being an African-American and a lesbian married to a French woman. They have 2 children. So I want to play another clip, and this is from your 2009 HBO special, I'ma Be Me. Which sounds kind of funny coming from my mouth, doesn't it?
But you nailed it.
Oh,
I'm
thank
telling you.
You.
I was very impressed. I was like, oh, go ahead, Terry. She nailed that. I'm going to be me.
So this is a clip about how it's getting harder to be black and a lesbian. And this is from 2009.
It's harder being gay than it is being black. It is. Because there's some things that I had, there's some things that I had to do as gay that I didn't have to do as black. I didn't have to come out black. I didn't have to sit my parents down and tell them about my blackness. I didn't have to sit them down. Mom, Dad, I gotta tell y'all something. I hope you still love me. I'm just gonna say it. Mom, Dad, I'm black. What? What did she just say? Oh, Lord Jesus, she didn't say black, Lord. Did she say black? Mom, I'm black. Oh, no, Lord Jesus, that's black, Lord. Oh, that's black, Lord. Anything but black, Jesus. Give her cancer, Lord. Give her cancer. But black, Lord.
That's hilarious. How did you think about that? I mean, how did you come up with that?
I guess it was the realization I had to have this conversation with my parents about being a lesbian, and I was like, wow, this is kind of ridiculous, and it was very difficult. And, you know, this is after, now we have Barack Obama as president, and I thought about it that I had more rights as African American than I did as being, a gay American. Because that night when he won, it was bittersweet. You know, I was so super excited and happy and proud of our country and in the direction we were going, and I'm living in California, so in the same time, Prop 8 passed. So,
and Prop 8 says that the only marriage the state would recognize is a marriage between a man and a woman.
Exactly. So then that passed, and it's like, okay, so we move forward, but then they take away my rights to be married. So, yeah, it felt like, wow, now I can't believe now it's actually harder to be gay than to be African American. And that joke was, in for that time, especially now that we do have marriage equality, but there's still a lot of things that we need protection from, like jobs and housing. So it is still, a fight out there. But I don't know. Like right now, no, I don't think it is harder today.
You actually came out during an anti-Prop 8 rally, right? Mm-hmm. You came out publicly.
Right.
How did you choose that as the opportunity to do it?
Well, I didn't even know that I was going to do it. It wasn't planned at all. I was in Vegas performing at, I think, Planet Hollywood, and I had a show that night. And there was the National Day of Protest, and the LGBT Center in Vegas, they were holding a rally. So it's like, hey, let's go out and support and protest. So I get there, and it's a large crowd, and the head of the center, she's speaking, and she said, we have someone out here who's an ally, and she's a strong voice for the community, and I'm just going to put her on the spot and see if she will come up and say a few words. Now, I'm looking around in the audience thinking, is Drew Barrymore here, or is Pink here? What's going on? I'm looking around for the ally, and then she said, Wanda Sykes. I'm like, oh, no, I'm part of the family. I'm not the ally. Okay, so I go up, and it just happened, and I made the speech, and then when we started the march, my friends were there, and they were like, you just came out. I was like, huh? And they were like, yeah. I was like, oh, I guess I did. My wife was there, and we went on with the march, and then when I got home back to the hotel room, I should say, when I got back to the hotel room, I'm looking at CNN, and now I'm on the crawl. And I was like, oh, boy. Okay. I guess I did.
What did you say that was the official coming out?
I said, I'm proud to be black, a woman, and gay.
So once the crawl hit CNN, what happened next in your life?
A lot of text messages. My publicist called and said congratulations, and she was proud of me, and she said that was the perfect way to do it. What else? Yeah, a lot of very supportive phone calls, and it took my parents a while to jump on board.
Is that how they found out, or did you already tell them?
No, I had already had the conversation with them. Mm-hmm. But I remember my mother specifically asking me not to do that, not to be public while she was, you know, still alive.
Well, how do you handle that? Because your life is yours, and there's a fight to be fought, and you wanted to be part of it, but I'm sure you also wanted to respect your mother. So what do you honor? Do you honor, like, the LGBTQ movement? Do you honor your own sexuality? Do you honor your wife? Or do you suppress all that for a while your mother's still alive, and honor your mother?
It was hard. And, you know, deep down, I look at it as I am honoring my mother, because I'm a product of my parents. And my parents instilled these values and this strength in me. And so for me to deny who I am and to be silent, then I think that would be dishonoring them, because that's not the person that they, you know, made me to be. So I had that conversation with them from that angle, and I, you know, eventually they got it. And now, you know, we are so close, and everything is great. They're amazing grandparents. And you know, I think now their concern is more for my safety than anything else.
I'm really glad to hear that things are good between you.
Thank you.
Do you think your mother was more surprised than she might have been, because you, in the 90s, you were married to a man for several years?
I think so. Yeah, I can see how that could be misleading. the old bait and switch. I can see that.
So your wife is French. She's white. Mm-hmm. You have two children who are white. Mm-hmm. And you joke mm-hmm. about how you're living in a house with white people, and you're a minority in your own home. So that's very funny. But I'm sure there's some truth to that, too. Is it unusual for you to be in your own home and be like the racial minority in your own family?
It is. It feels weird when I think about it. But now, when it's just the four of us, then, you know, if I don't think I think of it then, but it's like when her family is there, or we have a bunch of friends over. I do kind of look around and I go, man, there's a lot of white people in my house right now. Wow. And it's not like I don't like it or it makes me uncomfortable. It's just I noticed it, you know, and it's like, wow, okay. And sometimes I'll call a friend like, hey, man, what you doing? You want to come over? And he goes, what, you got too many white people in your house? I'm like, yeah.
Had you considered motherhood when you were in a heterosexual marriage? And when you imagined the possibility of motherhood, if you imagined it, did you imagine it differently in a straight marriage than you did when you were in, as you are now, in a lesbian marriage? Because now you're the mother of two children.
Before, no, I didn't want kids. I had no vision of having kids at all. I remember when I was little, I said, I pictured myself with kids, but there was never a man around. It was, I don't know if maybe he died in my mind or something. I don't know. But I did see myself with kids, but there was never a, you know, a dad around. That was when I was little. Now, then when I was older, I was like, oh, God, no. No kids. I don't want kids. And when I met my wife, that was her thing. Look, I'm right up front. I want kids. And I was like, well, can you give me like 6 months to think about it? And let's just continue dating and then we'll see. And if I know it's not for me, then, you know, then we'll just call this quits and you go on and find somebody who wants to have kids. So she agreed. So, but after that 6 months, even before then, I quickly was like, you know, why wouldn't you want kids? Why wouldn't you want to start a family with this person? And the best decision I've ever made.
What do you love about being a mother?
I guess it takes you out of yourself, you know? Just to be able to just love something so much and just want to be there and take care of them and not worry about yourself. It's just good to know that I have that capability. You know, it's like, oh, I can do this. Oh, I thought I was so self-absorbed, but this is, wow, look at me parenting and being caring about something else, you know, other than myself. Yeah, it's just beautiful. I'm just learning a lot about myself. So I guess that is kind of like about me again. Damn it! I thought I had this.
So your wife gave birth to twins, and you joke in your latest comedy special about how people are always asking you, because your two children are white, how come you didn't choose an African-American donor so that the children would be biracial and would reflect both of you instead of the donor being white. So you joke about that in the special, but you must have had pretty serious conversations about that.
We didn't have that many conversations about it. I was good with it. I was like, look, you're doing all the heavy lifting. You're getting the shots. You're going through the process. You're going to carry them. You're delivering them. Of course you want the kids to look like you. Why not? You earned it. Go for it. And also I was like, why do the kids need to look biracial to mirror us? Like I said, we're two women. We can't make a baby. So their skin color to me wasn't like, you know, something that I needed to feel like they're my kids. That, you know, they are my kids, and they identify us as the French mom and the English mom.
Were you surprised you had twins?
No, we put two back. We put two eggs back. And
And thinking maybe one of them wouldn't take.
Right. And she wanted to put three back. And I was like, look, I'm going to tell you right now, if all three take, we leaving one at the hospital. That's the deal. So she said, "All right, you know," and also the doctor advised not to put three back. So we just did two.
Right. Okay. So some of your material now is really very personal, and some of the things that like women are reluctant to talk about, you talk about on stage. For example, going through menopause, having a belly in part because you're going through menopause. You've even named your belly Esther Roll after the actress.
Yep.
How did you decide to do that?
I don't know. It was like when it popped up, I was like, "Oh my God, look at this fat roll I have right here. Where'd that come from?" And I don't. Then I just started I just gave it a voice one day. You know, I think I was ordering food, and I was like, "You know, I should get a salad." And then I just looked at my gut, and it was like, I want some French fries. And I was like, okay, all right, you're right. And I would have conversations with my gut, and my friends would crack up. I think the first time I did it, I was with my friend Kim Whitley, and she just died laughing. She's another comedian. She died laughing, and I think Esther wanted French fries, and I said, Esther, they don't have fries. They don't fries on the menu. And Kim was like, yes, that's fries. I said, shh. I said, Esther can't read. She's dumb. She can't read. And Kim just started laughing. And she's like, I heard that. So and then it just became a thing. And she's like, you have to do that on stage. She's like, girl, you have to. Esther, people will love Esther. You have to. And I put Esther out there, and everybody loves her.
Well, Wanda Sykes, thank you so much for talking with us. It's really been great. I really appreciate it.
Well, thank you. I appreciate it, Terry. Thank you.
Wanda Sykes' Netflix comedy special is called Not Normal, is nominated for 2 Emmys. Coming up, we hear from crime novelist Laura Lippman, author of the Tess Monaghan detective series and a new standalone mystery novel called Lady in the Lake. This is Fresh Air Weekend.
Support for NPR and the following message come from The Real Real, the leading reseller of authenticated luxury items. Shop luxury clothing, accessories, and fine art at unreal prices. From your favorite designers like Louis Vuitton, Gucci, Cartier, and hundreds more. And The Real Real authenticates each item to ensure it's guaranteed authentic. Shop in-store, on the app, or at therealreal.com and receive 20% off select items with promo code REAL.
Support for this NPR podcast and the following message come from BetterHelp. BetterHelp offers licensed professional counselors who specialize in issues such as depression, stress, anxiety, and more. Connect with your professional counselor in a safe and private online environment at your convenience. Get help at your own time and your own pace. Schedule secure video or phone sessions, plus chat and text with your therapist. Visit betterhelp.com/freshair to learn more and get 10% off your first month.
My guest, Laura Lippman, is well known for her popular series of novels set in Baltimore featuring Detective Tess Monaghan. Her new standalone novel, Lady in the Lake, was described as extraordinary by Stephen King in his New York Times Book Review. The novel is set in Baltimore in the mid-1960s. The main character, Maddie Schwartz, is in her late 30s, trying to start a new life as an independent woman after leaving her husband and moving from the suburbs to the city. She manages to find the body of an 11-year-old white girl who'd gone missing. Rather than just give her story to a reporter at the paper, Maddie insists on sharing the byline. That helps her land a job as an assistant to the helpline columnist at the paper. She uses her newspaper credential to investigate the story behind another body, a young woman discovered in a fountain. Unlike the story of the dead white girl, no one at the paper is interested in this victim's story because she's black and worked at a cheap copy of the Playboy Club. The novel investigates issues of race, class, and sexism, as well as what life was like at city newspapers in the mid-60s. Lippman's father was an editorial writer and columnist at the Baltimore Sun at the time the novel set. Laura Lippman later worked as a reporter there. Laura Lippman, welcome to Fresh Air, and congratulations on this novel.
Thank you, and thank you for having me.
So I want to start by asking you about Trump's Baltimore tweet. You lived in Baltimore since you were 6. You worked for the Baltimore Sun, the newspaper there, and your Tess Monaghan detective series is set in Baltimore. Your first novel is called Baltimore Blues. And then, you know, when you think of Baltimore artists, you think of you, your husband David Simon, who did The Wire, set in Baltimore, and John Waters. So, all right, at least that's who I think of. So let me just recap the tweet. This was about Congressman Elijah Cummings, who chairs the Oversight Committee, which is investigating Trump. So Trump tweeted that Cummings' district is the worst in the USA. It is a dangerous and filthy place. It is a disgusting rat and rodent infested mess. No human being would want to live there. You live there?
I have lived in the city pretty consistently since 1989, when I finally got back there after 8 years of trying to get back there as a journalist.
The president has insulted your city and your former profession, journalism. The media is the enemy of the people. So what's your reaction to that?
When it comes to the criticism of the media, I hold the president of the United States responsible for a coarsening of rhetoric that has empowered and emboldened people, including the person who came to the Annapolis Capital Gazette last summer and shot and killed 5 people, including my friend Rob Hiasen. And people point to that and they say, that's not fair. This was a grudge that predated the 2016 election. You're just being slippery with your facts. And I think it is fair. And I tell people, of course I think rhetoric matters. Of course I think words matter. Look at what I do for a living. And at a time when I know newspapers to be really embattled, and the people who work at my former newspaper, the Baltimore Sun, they haven't had a raise for 6 years. They're down to a skeleton staff, and they're doing a great job of covering the city. They're the ones who uncovered the malfeasance that the president then mocked, the scandal that engulfed our now former mayor, who had to step down. How do you think these stories come to light? And to hear what such hardworking people do mocked as fake news or lies, and to see people encouraged not to take them seriously and to consider them enemies, they're the opposite of that.
I should mention that you turned in your manuscript, or maybe it's that you completed your first draft the day before the shooting at the newspaper that you just mentioned, where your friend was one of 5 people who were killed, and the book is dedicated to those 5 people and their families.
That's correct. I turned the book in on June 27th, and as a reward to myself and my daughter, we headed toward the beach where my mother lives. And we had just crossed the Chesapeake Bay Bridge, had lunch, and I checked in with my mother, and I said, we should be there soon. Did you run into traffic in Annapolis, she asked me, and I said, no, why would I have run into traffic there at midday? And she said, there's been a shooting. And what I can't get over is that microsecond of being blasé and numb about it, of receiving that news and being almost accepting of it and asking my mother, oh, where was it? And then, of course, her answer turned my world upside down, because my friend worked there and I knew it was very likely that he would be one of the victims.
Why did you think he would be one of the victims?
He was an editor, so chances are he would be in the newsroom at that time. And this is going to sound really silly. I spent the next hour and a half on Bluetooth talking to friends from all over the place. We were all engaged in this really magical thinking about why Rob would be alive. And part of it was, as a reporter, Rob loved to be out of the office. Rob was so well known at the Baltimore Sun as the person who couldn't stand to be at his desk. He wanted to be out there in the city finding stories. But he was an editor. And then it was, well, maybe there's a reason he's not checking in on social media. And we would made up reasons for that. And I had literally pulled into my mother's driveway. I can hear the crunch of the shells under my wheels when my friend John Morgan, who was on vacation in Michigan and was also very close to Rob, John now works at Bloomberg, called me and said, it's official, he's among the dead. And I burst into tears. I won't repeat the expletive I said, but I was like, John, he's just so tall. You know, the idea of this 6'5" man who couldn't be missed by a shooter. And we were both kind of crying, laughing at the same time. And I am still crying thinking about it. I don't know how his wife and his kids get by day to day. Maria, his wife, has become an amazing champion of groups that aim to stop gun violence in our country. And I admire her so much.
So you're a crime writer. I mean, your books are all about crimes and solving crimes. And a very dear friend of yours was actually murdered. Has that affected how you want to write about murder and crime?
I'm happy to say that at least I can in good conscience feel that for quite some time now, my work has been centered in a respect for victims and a hope that people who read my books feel that respect and understand that I'm not really interested in cheap sensation or victims as MacGuffins. And the book that I turned in the day before Rob was killed was a book that ultimately gives its story to the victim.
It literally gives her voice.
She is the first person we hear from, and she is the last person we hear from. And she has what I consider to be the most important line in the entire book, when from across a void, as she presents herself as a ghost, she says to the woman who's so determined to know her story, "You are interested in my death, not my life. It's not the same thing."
I want you to read a paragraph from your novel that describes the newsroom when your main character, a woman, walks into it for the first time.
Maddie's first impression of the newsroom was that it was, well, filthy. Filthy and loud. So many newspapers piled everywhere. People shouting, typewriters clacking, a bell ringing somewhere. And so many men. But there were women working here, she reminded herself. She had read their bylines, seen their stories. Women could be reporters, too.
Compare that to your memories of the Baltimore Sun newsroom when your father worked there and you were a child and would visit him there.
The newsroom that my father joined was one where, as an august editorial writer, he had a private office with a door. He kept a dartboard in there where, at one point, Spiro Agnew's portrait was at the center of that dartboard. It was loud and raucous and fascinating.
You know, I'm thinking one of the stories in your new novel, Lady in the Lake, involves the main character, Maddie, who's the newspaper. She wants to become a newspaper reporter, and her ticket in is that she's found a body, and one of the stories she's working on leads to the discovery of another body, and she wants to be the person investigating this. When she was younger, when she was 17, she had a relationship with an older man who was actually the father of a boy who the main character had been dating in high school. And I don't think it ever quite occurs to her how predatory a relationship like that probably was.
No, she's very much a person of her times. And first of all, she's bought into the older man's logic that he's bestowed something special on her, that he's seen something special in her. He's flattered her. He's described her as a libertine and someone who wasn't made to live inside the normal strictures of the society they're in.
And that he was going to give her the freedom to express her body fully. And because she's a queen and he's a king.
Yes. And they're special. They stand, you know, they're not like everybody else. But, you know, Maddie Schwartz in the novel, she's playing what she thinks is a winning hand. She's a beautiful woman in a world where beauty is pretty much the best thing that a woman can bring to the table. And she's been granted that, and she plays that card, and she's very happy with it. Doesn't occur to her to ever second guess it or think, well, is that right? Is that fair? Is that how women should be judged? It's like, this is how women are judged. I got it. I'm going to use it.
And the older reporter who is a woman at the paper where Maddie's trying to work, She looks at Maddie and she basically thinks, God, these young women, they try to use their bodies. They want to, like, date the newspaper men. I never made a mistake like that. And it's just a really interesting dynamic that you've created there that I don't interact very much. But, of course, there is a chapter from the point of view of the older woman who's been a reporter for a long time covering the labor beat, because you get into the heads of everybody in the book almost. So just talk a little bit about that, creating that dynamic between two generations of working women.
So I came into newsrooms when women maybe 5 to 10 years older than I am had done a lot of the heavy lifting. There were ones who had really, like, knocked in the door, and they had to be so tough. And I always said I was of the generation where we had now reached the point where one could go cry in the bathroom. You still couldn't cry in public, but you could cry in the bathroom. And I did a lot of crying in the bathroom when I was a reporter. And so I kind of kept backing it up and thinking, okay, and so the generation before that, how much tougher did they have to be? I mean, there have always been women reporters, you know, but they've always been tough as nails, in my opinion, in the best possible way. And, you know, I know that as a young reporter, I often seemed silly and flighty to some of the women I worked with, perhaps fairly so. And, you know, aspired to have them take me seriously because they took themselves seriously and they took the business seriously. So I was really aware of all of that history.
When you'd be crying in the bathroom, what are some of the things you'd be crying about?
The one that stands out most vividly in my mind is when I'm a very young reporter in Waco, Texas, and we get these little slips of paper in our mail slots. I used this to a certain extent in Lady of the Lake. And you would have this assignment written on a piece of paper. And one day I reached into my box and I was asked to go cover the christening ceremony, if you will, for the new public bathrooms in a city park. And the thing that just destroyed me was, first of all, the editor who gave me this assignment, with no sense of fun or irony or any idea that he was making a very bad joke, asked me to get all the poop. So that was indignity number one. But the worst part was the last three words were, "No big deal." In case I thought this is my big break, "No big deal," you know, dampen those hopes. It's really not, it's not going to be a page one story. And at that moment, I just thought, is this my life? And I can still see myself standing in the bathroom at the Waco Tribune Herald, crying and looking out at the parking lot.
Your husband, David Simon, is very well known because he created The Wire and Treme, two of his series for HBO. And he's now adapting Philip Roth's best-selling novel, The Plot Against America. You were both newspaper reporters. Did you meet at the newspaper?
We met at the newspaper, I think it was 1990, because when I arrived at the Evening Sun, David was on leave writing the book that would become Homicide. We met. It's a cute story, because I came to work one day, this would have been in 90 or 91, and I had a blotter, one of those big old-fashioned paper things with the calendar, and my blotter was covered in a coffee stain. And I looked around, I said, "Who was working at my desk last night?" And someone said, "Oh, you know, Simon was there." And I was furious, and I accosted him and said, "You just spill coffee all over my desk and you blot it up with the blotter?" And he admitted that he had, and he apologized, and I asked him to give me a copy of his book, Homicide, and we still have it, obviously, and it's inscribed, "Do you want cream with that, hon?" And he was my colleague for the years he was at The Sun. He took the same buyout as my dad in 1995. In 1997, we got to know each other a little bit better because we were both promoting our second books that fall. And then his marriage ended. Later, my marriage ended. And, you know, we call it Smaltimore for a reason. There are just not that many people. And so it just seemed natural to start dating and, you know, we ended up moving in together, I think, within 2 years of starting to date, and then marrying a couple of years after that.
I want to thank you so much for talking with us. It's really just been a pleasure.
It's been a delight for me.
Laura Lippman's new novel is called Lady in the Lake. Fresh Air Weekend is produced by Teresa Madden. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our technical director and engineer is Audrey Bentham. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Roberto Shurrock, Mooj Zaidi, Thea Chaloner, and Seth Kelly. Molly C.V. Nesper is our associate producer of digital media. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Noom, offering a personalized weight loss program that uses psychology and small goals to change habits with the goal of losing weight and keeping it off for good. Learn more at Noom, Noom.com. And from Progressive Insurance, offering Snapshot, a device that adjusts insurance rates based on safe driving habits. Now that's Progressive. Learn more at Progressive.com or 1-800-PROGRESSIVE.